welcome to our Saturday Night Podcast. On today's podcast, Ian Rankin, Roddy Lumsden and others discuss the difference between music lyrics and poetry. Robert Crawford and Angus Peter Campbell give different perspectives on Scottish poets of the Enlightenment. Roddy Lumsden reads from his new collection, Third Wish Wasted. And we visit Stanza's Poetry Market and hear some homecoming haiku directed by Colin Will. But we start things off with today's Poetry Breakfast, which was on the topic of can we view song lyrics as poetry? Roddy Lumsden starts the ball rolling.
This is something that I've talked about a lot, written articles about, written even a book about in the past, the business of are songs poems, are poems songs. And I've come down to this simple definition that it's to do with intent. If someone writes a song as a song, it's a song. And if someone writes a poem, it's a poem. Now, there's no doubt that there are songs that are poetic. There's no doubt that there are poems that are song-like based on song structures and that are possible to set to music. But there's no point in my mind in saying A Case of You by Joni Mitchell, it's not a song, it's a poem, because it's not a poem, she didn't write it as a poem. But yes, I know occasionally that people sneak lyrics by Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan into poetry anthologies, but it's really a bit of cousin borrowing as far as I'm concerned. So that's my take on it, it's down to intent.
Next up was Stephen Scobie.
I'm going to start by quoting the best authority I know on this question. That is me. The major distinction between poetry and song is that a poem is capable of functioning fully and perfectly as nothing more than words on the printed page. Other things can be added to it. One may well want to hear the poet read it aloud. You may enjoy a musical setting of it, but these are optional extras. Take them all away, and the poem would still survive. A song, however, depends upon music and vocal performance. It does not function fully and perfectly as words on a page. The voice that sings the song does not have to be conventionally or traditionally quote-unquote musical. It can, without any notion of traditional tunefulness, become so much a part of the song's essence that any other singer's version becomes, at best, secondary. And what I have here in mind are the two greatest singing voices of the late 20th century, Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen. But having offered that one definition of a possible distinction between poem and song, I want to go on and blur it a bit. Poem-song is not for me an absolute separation. It's rather a kind of continuum. And different poems, different songs will occupy different spots along that continuum.
We then turn to Marco Fazzini, the renowned Italian translator and poet, for his thoughts.
There is no clear distinction when we talk about works of some quality, between high and low art, or between, in this case, song and poetry. In 2002, I published a little book with three songs by Robert Burns in Italian translation. And even though it was Burns' stanza structures and rhymes, which I wanted to reproduce most, my translations of All the Airs, The Red, Red Rose, and John Anderson, My Joe, resulted to be just mere literary achievements in a way. So they couldn't be sung. I never considered Burns' songs less than poetry, yet the economy of words and all the monosyllables are quite hard to translate in Italian. People often want to know when the subject of writing for music comes up, whether the music or the text comes first. If the music does indeed comes first, then the lyricist had better think of his work as something rather less than poetry, for it is rather too much to expect that words fitted the pre-existent music can amount to such more than professional job. I never considered Burns' lyrics something less than poetry. And I never wanted my translations of his songs to be less than Italian poetry or Italian songs or singable poems.
As if in search for more clues as to the answer to this question, we turn to Edinburgh-based crime writer Ian Rankin for some answers.
The earliest things I ever wrote that I remember writing were song lyrics for my non-existent band, The Amoebas, when I was about 12 years old, 13 years old. I mean, to me, there was no, you know, song lyrics were poetry. But I think it's a very much an adolescent thing, and maybe it's an adolescent bloke thing. You know, I mean, I would sit there poring over my lyrics of my Van de Graaff generator albums, and there would be Pete Hamill singing about paraplegic dancers in formation team. Like paraplegic dancers in formation team, my understanding seems at odds with its meaning. And I go, wow, whoa, you know. But when you're young and you're in love with language, you're excited by all these things. And I would sit and sort of try and work out what Dark Side of the Moon was about. You know, a metaphor for madness. That's a fantastic metaphor for madness. And a line like, you know, hanging on in quiet desperation is the English way. Sounds like a line that could have come from many an English poet of the era. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so enamored was I of people like Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen as a teenager that I actually shelled out hard-earned cash on their books of, you know, lyrics and poems. And I remember sitting with Suzanne, blank on the page as a lyric, and reading it and thinking, this just isn't, he hasn't got it at all. You know, I mean, when you're listening to the song, it sounds absolutely fantastic, and then you read it on the page and he's got you for the first bit of it. You know, you're going, okay, you're out with this woman Suzanne, she's the most erotic creature in the world, she's feeding you tea and oranges, this is absolutely fantastic. And then suddenly, hang on, what's Jesus doing coming into this? Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and you go, what? And you know, you're mentally starting to detumesce. And the song, it works in the song, but in some way that didn't work blank. And it was the same with Desolation Row by Dylan, which I listened to an album and went, oh my God, this is the best thing I've ever heard. Read it on the page and thought, it doesn't really work.
The discussion lasted for over an hour, and we didn't quite reach a conclusion at the end. And it was suggested that perhaps we should meet up for a week to try and discuss all the different issues that came up. Next up, we have an event that was extremely interesting, where Robert Crawford and the acclaimed Gaelic poet and novelist Angus Peter Campbell discussed Poets of the Scottish Enlightenment, looking at it from the Scots and the Gaelic perspective. We start things off with Robert Crawford, who begins by reading a poem by Burns, My Heart's in the Highlands.
My heart's in the Highlands. My heart is not here. My heart's in the Highlands, a-chasing the deer, chasing the wild deer and following the roe. My heart's in the Highlands, wherever I go. Farewell to the Highlands, farewell to the North, the birthplace of valour, the country of worth. Wherever I wander, wherever I rove, the hills of the Highlands forever I love. Farewell to the mountains high covered with snow. Farewell to the straths and green valleys below. Farewell to the forests and wild hanging woods. Farewell to the torrents and loud pouring floods. My heart's in the Highlands. My heart is not here. My heart's in the Highlands, a-chasing the deer, chasing the wild deer and following the roe. My heart's in the Highlands, wherever I go. It would be impossible to imagine that poem having been written by a lowland poet of an earlier generation than Burns. And we usually hear it as a Jacobite song, about someone who is exiled from his native land. And we don't think of Burns as a pious or religious poet. We tend to think of him wrongly often, but as someone who attacks religion. He doesn't quite attack religion, but he attacks religious hypocrisy. But I think that notion of that poem there as an elegiac, an almost funereal poem, however strange it might seem to us here, is a valid reading of the poem. And Burns's take on the Highlands in that poem is conditioned by the poetry of Ossian, whose work Burns was so enthusiastic. You know, in Burns' first edition of his poems, there are various footnotes to Ossian. He has one poem that's divided, like Ossian's work, into duons, different separate songs. And Burns loved Ossian, and we find Ossian very, very hard to like now. And so this seems strange to us. But why Ossian is so important, really, these poems published by James Macpherson from 1760 onwards, at the heart of the Scottish Enlightenment, why these are seen as so important, why, say, Ezra Pound in the 20th century says that the Romantic movement begins with Ossian, which is perhaps an odd thing to say about someone writing middle of the Scottish Enlightenment, but Pound's right, the Romantic movement begins with Ossian. It's the tonality of the poems, which, as in My Heart's in the Highlands, is a tonality of grief, of loss, of melancholy associated with the Highland. And I get fed up with historians who are so often unimaginative people, and so they don't have a good feel for literature, talking about Ossian as a fake, as a phony. You know, that's just boring. You know, it's this kind of the worst of these people, Hugh Trevor Roper, who doesn't seem to have any sense that literature is about making things up. That it's not about history, it's not about an accurate version of what the truth was, it's about imagination. And Macpherson enacts a wonderful imaginative transformation of the Highlands. And so, however phony we may think the material, it is the most influential outgrowth of Gaelic culture in the history of Gaelic culture. And it seems to me foolish to deny that. I understand why contemporary and other later Gaelic writers might enormously resent this being foisted onto their culture. But it seems to be naive not to salute the power of the imagination that has done this. We don't still need to live in the Ossian scape. We're no longer living in the 3rd century or in the 18th century, and identity is something that's dynamic, it's not something that's unchanging. And that too is part of the message of Ossian and Walter Scott. These are dynamic, transforming imaginations. They're at the heart of the Scottish Enlightenment.
Angus Peter Campbell responded by agreeing with many of the points that Robert had talked about. But we'll focus on him reading from a poem by the Gaelic poet Rob Down.
That goes, Dunyan after it brishigat, Shefistrahat the Hach, Sclavoring at Ingendat, which in kind of silver grass, Ach Yinigat is Rukagat, is Hokagat, is Gaz, Chaistrach can tool Harishara, Smigirig, with a bass. Three misers. Who died in their misery. And Rob Del Mackay describes them in Donald Meek's translation in English. These were folk who broke no rules, and as far as anyone's aware, nor did they do anything which the world describes as grace. But they were conceived, and they were born, and they were brought up, and they grew up. A stretch of life went over them, and at last they died. I think he was a great Gaelic cynic, Rob Down. And in that stanza, he predates Edward Muir's Covenant with Silence. He speaks directly to a people and a populace who do not rage against the dying of the light. He speaks against the silence which Mandelstam described as the greatest evil, that they were born, that they lived, that they died.
Both Angus Peter Campbell and Robert Crawford spoke very eloquently about this topic, but unfortunately there isn't quite space to cram everything that they said in. And hopefully we'll be posting the full version of their event. We now move on to the St Andrews born poet Roddy Lumsden, who launched his book today, Third Wish Wasted, from Blood Axe. And we were very, very privileged to have him read from this new collection. It's now over to Roddy.
Religion has been the number one cause of wars. Number two cause of wars? Anyone? Spice. Although, of course, it's connected with money. Yeah, the spice trade was responsible for untold amounts of deaths back in the day. A story of spice. Since we are human, and we seek what is beyond the ear, behind the yard's back wall, all that lies outside our giddy orbis, we have sent caravels and coracles and caravans across tasky seas of sand or salt, slow-blooming enterprise, our coins thrown into such wells, our wishes bright against a sullen sky, and have surrendered one in five, a thumb lopped off, to pools of fire, to brawling clans who came our way as we went theirs, and all to bring the scorch and tan in sacks and jars with which our cooks will bind and brim the evening air, while men draw ale and women dance and children run through golden fields to golden homes. Golden is on the banned list. The list we made, myself and about 10 other poets made a list of words which must not be used in poems herewith. And golden was on there, so it's okay if you use it twice, it cancels out the contraband. Some scientists think there's a rational explanation for ghosts. And the name given to this theory is stone tape theory. The idea being that just as cassette tape can capture sounds and images, so might an old wall or a cliff face be able to capture images and sounds from the past, and at random, a long time later, suddenly replay them. So it is scientifically possible that when people see headless centurions or the dog up round the corner there that walks, does it walk above the, or does it walk halfway through? Halfway through, yeah. Where's that?
Dean's Court,
yeah, the Dean's Court dog. Anyone seen it? So there could be a reason for these things. This is the poem I wrote about that. I tried to write about this subject three times before, this was the third time, and I managed to write a poem I was happy with about it. And I went into the kitchen one night late on, and I pulled a bit of naan bread off some leftover Indian takeaway and dipped it in the vindaloo sauce and brought it up to my mouth. I just thought how this is such an archetypal gesture, lifting your hand to your mouth, and I suddenly had a cosmic moment that I thought, I'm one of so many people stretching back to the cave times. Probably the dinosaurs lifted their hands to their mouths as well. Whosoever has pushed a tear of bread into a glossy pool of gravy has entered history, paying the ticket price, playing statues as they lift to their mouths a fine brine of self, striking the figures of those minor gods who light the mineral tapes of creek and cliff, the shirtless walker raising his palm to close out the sun's clamour, or some castaway fetching up the cold gush to her lips as she hangs at the stream, and a dawn hunter dipping his thumb in a kicking breeze to taste the is, are, am, to prove future. This is a New York poem. I'm very fond of New York. Absolutely, it's the only place I feel absolutely at peace. And I also love Chinese food. And this is a poem I wrote in my head while I was having a Chinese meal in the West Village at a place called Sammy's Noodle House and Grill, which is also the title of the poem. And it's a question and answer poem. What did you order? The soup with wontons, char siu and duck. The short ribs with black beans, a steam tin of the pork shrimp shumai. And what was good? Beakers of ice water the waiters kept filling, the fulminous tea, the dizzying broth, the dim sun, the bullion of ribs rolled along tongue and tooth, the slight bite to the beans. What disappointed! The sour breath of my neighbour's English broccoli, and the duck, but the duck always does, with its coupe tang, an inch of fat. What was the weather? Snowflakes slanted on the West Village, Easter Sunday. And who was your companion? The fine wool overcoat of the man at the next table was draped on the seat opposite me. How was the matter resolved? With empty plates, and partly empty plates, and the residue of ice, and my neighbours nodding and bowing and gone, and the waiters going and coming, and napkins and dollars and solace, and a grin against the snipping wind from the south. Will the world end in the lifetimes of our children? I can't say, not for sure. When I was on the Reader's Free programme, The Verb, the other week, Ian McMillan introduced this book by saying it's got everything in it. It's got love, history, science, and Liberace. And this is Liberace. I'm interested in Liberace because I have something in common with him in that I've got a brain that keeps hold of facts, pointless facts. And they reckon one of the reasons that Liberace managed to stay so famous for so long is because he had an amazing brain for people's names. And he would also kind of ask people questions. So he would say to someone, the doorman at some theatre, you know, what's your mother's name and what's your dog's name? And 20 years later, coming back to the same theatre, he would say to the doorman, how's your dog Trixie and things like that. He just managed to keep all that in. And that people really appreciated the fact that he remembered all these things. About two-thirds of the way through this poem, there's a list of magazine titles, which it's not apparent in my reading, so when that bit comes, you'll know that's what it is. In Liberace's memory. First comes love. Because you knew the backroom boys keep the chains oiled. The theatre secretary keeps the boss in line. The doorman sees to the little things that matter. You learn their names. Asked after kids and mothers, remembered that Larry, who drew up contracts in Boston, shared your taste for iced buns, that Heidelman's assistant was Shula and not Sheila, and stored all this information there beneath your perfect bouffant in perfect fashion. Old kittenish on the keys, they called you, while Whisper magazine claimed all your hormones were in your fingers. Fingers that made you a half-decent Midwest Paderewski. An 88-key, 2000s-tune jukebox already inside your marcelled mind. And room still for flashbacks of all those muscled tricks. The Hilton, custom grands, rocks dripping from a silk three-piece, skin flicks. The Phantom Five silver Rolls-Royce you had shipped back from London, where the Queen requested to touch your virgin fox fur train and watched you showboat from the royal box. Everywhere you made it, and everywhere you made it into, the motorhomes and jump rope songs, top secret, hush, and private lives, the pickup trucks of Mexicans you cruised in parking lots, atop at the top, the American dream you dreamed in piano-shaped beds of chandeliers and chauffeurs, cascades of toy dogs down velveteen stairs. And every year of Vegas year, from the rhinestone footlights of the Pabst Theatre, Milwaukee famous, to late headlights frisking Camellia Street and Valley Vista Boulevard glistening, you never did forget yourself. Not one word. This is the poem that I wrote for Kate Moss to read. And you can hear her reading it on the internet if you want. If you put Kate Moss in poetry into YouTube, you'll find Kate Moss, a little film of Kate Moss and her reading this poem. It's a poem about adversity and rising above that. bloom. You who thrived where the horse trod, where the apple smashed, who shot up straight where the river sloshed and rolled, who rose from blood, who ran your flag up from the grifting dune and pulled the pale sky down, who budded on a sodden sack or log, took seed and caught along the track's edge, who jinked from crags and where walls slip, who broached the lip of lintels, burst on finial and ledge, you who tested luck and unluck, thrift fed, driven by wind and water, frost ticking each petal, roping root and stem, the black of black nights lost to hope, you cast the fine day as your fetch, and when it knocked and brought your wish, and you were found, you grew. This is the poem that I wrote for Kate Moss to read. And you can hear her reading it on the internet if you want. If you put Kate Moss and poetry into YouTube, you'll find Kate Moss, a little film of Kate Moss and her reading this poem. It's a poem about adversity and rising above that. Bloom. You who thrived where the horse trod, where the apple smashed, who shot up straight where the river sloshed and rolled, who rose from blood, who ran your flag up from the grifting dune and pulled the pale sky down, who budded on a sodden sack or log, took seed and caught along the track's edge, who jinked from crags and where walls slip, who broached the lip of lintels, burst on finial and ledge, you who tested luck and unluck, thrift fed, driven by wind and water, frost ticking each petal, roping root and stem, the black of black nights lost to hope, you cast the fine day as your fetch, and when it knocked and brought your wish, and you were found, you grew.
And Roddy's new collection is available from Blood Axe. This year, Stanza had a poetry market that took place in the supper room of the town hall in St Andrews, and it was an abundance of poetry, with presses big and small, pamphlets, poetry magazines, stalls galore. It was a very lively event, and I took my recorder around and spoke to a number of people. And I started at the desk of Read This magazine.
So I'm here with Read This magazine, with Claire and...
Leon.
And Leon. Okay, so how's it going?
It's going really well. Yeah, fantastic.
Have you been selling many copies of the magazine?
Well, the magazine's free.
Oh, it's free, of course.
So yes. We've been...
Or have you been giving away
have,
many copies?
We have given away a lot. Definitely. It's going really well. So
very good.
Very popular. Indeed. I think anything that's free is popular, but...
Well, not always.
I'd like to think it's because the magazine is attractive and high quality as well. But, yeah. So
tell me a little bit about the latest issue, the 100 Poems About Edinburgh.
It's a special issue, it's kind of set up as a taste of this collection, which is a project which aims to collect 100 short poems about Edinburgh and then have them made into short films by local filmmakers.
Okay.
So currently we're at the stage where we've collected the 100 poems, and the issue of the magazine is just to show people the poems before the films come along, basically, or give them a taste of it anyway.
And are the films in production at the moment?
We're currently rallying the filmmakers, getting them together, and they're kind of going through workshops at the moment where they're storyboarding and talking about their ideas and such and such. And we are still welcoming filmmakers into the fold. Okay. They still want to.
Do you have to be established filmmakers? I mean, for example,
absolutely not. No? We're happy to have anybody. We really want to get a good mix of films that are kind of even just made on people's phones, right up to people who have their own equipment and editing suites, and you know, anyone on the spectrum is welcome. And
if someone wants to pick a poem, or is it that they have to go through some sort of negotiation as to which poem they can make a film of?
Basically, we do want to let people pick their own poems, but at the same time we want to have all the poems made into films,
right.
So we might end up that some of them are very popular, and then there will be others that will say, you know, this one needs a filmmaker, will you give it a home?
Right.
But we're hoping that different people's tastes will mean that they'll all get filmmakers, you know, without us having to to intervene too much, but all the films will definitely, all the poems will definitely be made into films anyway. So.
We then chatted to the people at the Magma Poetry Stall.
Well, Magma Poetry has been around for about 12 years. We publish 3 issues a year, and we have a rotating editorship, which means that each issue is edited by a different person. That means that each issue, although there's a sort of Magma style, each issue is quite discreet and different and has its own character, which reflects the tastes and interests of the editor.
Excellent. And your current issue, who was the editor or editorial team of that?
That was David Bull and Andrew Nielsen, who are both members of the Magma board.
Okay.
But we also have guest editors from time to time, and our next guest editor is going to be not this coming issue, but the one after, and that would be Claire Pollard.
Okay.
So that should be a very interesting issue as well.
Okay.
The next one should be good too, 44.
And tell us a bit about what Magma Poetry has in it. So do you carry reviews and translations of poems? What are the sorts of things that are in Magma?
We have poetry, some unsolicited poetry and some commissioned. We have reviews, and we also pride ourselves on our prose, which we try to keep of a very high standard. We also very often have a feature called Presiding Spirits, where we ask a well-known poet to write a poem as a kind of homage to a poet they admire. And they'll write the poem, but then also comment on why they've chosen the poet and what it is that they admire about the poet.
Colin Will had set a challenge for the poetry market, which was that he wanted people to write haiku about the theme of homecoming. I asked him a little bit about it.
So Colin, when you're asking people to do haiku, so what is it you mean? Because certain people have certain preconceptions as to what haiku are.
I'm trying to help people who have never written haiku before to grasp the moment, because the haiku should be an expression of a moment in time. And I'm saying, ignore the rules today.
Okay.
Let's just go for what people are interested in writing.
So when people, like, you know, who've maybe heard of it, they think of this 5-7-5 constraint.
Uh-huh.
So what do you think of that, generally speaking? I mean,
well, if I'm writing classical haiku, then I do go for the 5-7-5 format. Thank you. But most Western haiku are written in either less or more than 17 syllables, because there is no strict equivalence between the Japanese onji and the Western word syllable. They mean different things, so that you can't really translate between the two languages. It's like the film, you know, it's lost in translation.
Okay.
And that exactly sums it up.
Very good. Okay. Excellent. And would you like to read us some haiku that you've... What's
yes.
the plural of haiku, by the way? Haiku?
Haiku.
Haiku.
No, haiku.
Haiku. Okay.
This is one by Nalini Paul. Nesting. Cliff ledges beckon. A yawning tidal embrace casts you back again. This is one by Rob McKenzie. Beijing, stomachache. Hotel, armed guard at Moscow. Edinburgh, dreams.
And we also had an Arabic entrant to the haiku competition. I started off by asking his name.
Adnan Al-Sayr, sha'ir from Iraq.
Okay, so Adnan. And Adnan's written a haiku for Master Will, and he's going to read it for us.
رسام قبل أن يكمل رسم القفص فر العصفور من اللوحة.
And here's the translation.
Adnan Al-Sayr's haiku.
Yep.
And translated by Marga Burbiartejo and Sally Evans. Freedom. Before he finished drawing the cage, the bird flew out of the painting.
Well, that's the end of today's podcast. As usual, there was so much stuff that we tried to pack in, but there just isn't enough room, and today's podcast is much larger than it normally ought to be. We'll be including material that we weren't able to include in these daily podcasts after the festival has finished. Thanks very much to Ewan McLean, who wrote and played the music that starts these podcasts, and to Jill Bowman for the performance that you're now listening to as we end tonight's podcast. Thanks very much for listening. My name's Colin Fraser, and I hope to see you tomorrow for our final daily podcast from the Stanza 2009 Festival here in the Byer Theatre in St Andrews. I wish you love.